Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parron. Disaster experts say there was little that Philippine authorities could have done to offset the devastation from last week's massive storm. There are fears that more than 10,000 people have been killed, and the United Nations and the Red Cross launched major appeals for funds. A U.S. aircraft carrier has arrived in the Philippines to deliver aid, and the international pledges are coming in from more and more countries. Bill Bertels reports.
The USS George Washington, en route from Hong Kong to the Philippines with 5,000 personnel aboard, is the biggest symbol of the international community's aid response to the Philippines. One by one, nations have been pledging more aid, with the UN launching an urgent appeal and the Red Cross calling for around $94 million in aid to support people in disaster-struck areas. The massive scale of Typhoon Haiyan overwhelmed Philippines authorities, raising questions about how well they were prepared for the disaster. But Simon Eckershall, the head of disaster and crisis management for the International Federation of the Red Cross, says preparations were made in advance.
In the Red Cross, we monitor the seasonal forecasts for typhoons in various parts of the world. And in the Philippines, which is unfortunately one of those countries that regularly is impacted by typhoons, we'd been monitoring this particular storm system for about a week. And as the storm had approached and as its intensity increased, we had also scaled up our efforts to do what we call preparedness for an imminent disaster. And that involves us pre-approving funding, moving non-food items closer to the areas we think are going to be affected, and importantly, giving the national society the necessary funding to move their volunteers around to help with evacuation and also to help with the early warning and early action messages that we give to people in the path of a storm like this.
He says Philippine authorities were well aware of the scale of the storm, but nonetheless struggled to cope.
Disaster preparedness is a marathon rather than a sprint. It's our day-in, day-out work is around raising the awareness with communities of the threat of all sorts of hazards and indeed preparing them when something imminent is approaching. So what we mean by disaster risk reduction or disaster preparedness is actually a way of engaging with the communities to help them put in place coping mechanisms when something like a storm comes along. And that could be around strengthening their house so that it will withstand the winds or the rain. It might have to do with diversifying their income base so that if they lose a livelihood like harvesting crops or fishing, they've got some other means to fall back on.
Hundreds of Red Cross volunteers have been watching the situation in the Philippines unfold from Sydney, where a major conference is taking place. Corazon Alma De Leon is the secretary of the Philippine Red Cross. She says the onus is on neighbouring countries to offer assistance.
We also need to see the ASEAN family of countries, ASEAN nations, must also be together. And this is why I mentioned in the interview that Vietnam recently approached us and said that because they were spared, they were very happy to donate and they'll put this together through our embassy in Vietnam, as an example.
On the ground, aid workers are preoccupied with trying to get access to the worst affected areas. Kirsten Mildren from the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs says the presence of the US military and a British warship which is on the way will make a big difference to aid delivery efforts.
So they have the technical expertise and equipment that can clear roads, that can fix airports, that can get control towers up and running within days. So we've had aid coming in on planes, through helicopters and whatever else, but now we expect to see it really dramatically increase with the help of the military. It's been a massive challenge, but we are starting to see aid get through.
As the United Nations launched a $300 million aid appeal for victims of Typhoon Haiyan, the Philippine government has imposed a curfew, deployed armored vehicles, and set up checkpoints to stop looting. Relief efforts have also been hampered by bad weather. Up to 11 million people have been affected by the typhoon, and many areas are yet to receive substantial help from authorities. Zoni Daniel has more from Samar, Philippines.
Each devastated village after devastated village escalates this humanitarian crisis. What we've found here, just on this one stretch of coast in Samar, is up to 30 villages that have been absolutely devastated. They've yet to see any real response from the national government. But what's interesting is the local government of the area has contacted directly the nearest large town, and they've come in to deliver food aid and medical treatment for those affected. I'm here with the Mayor of Beisei, and we're standing just very close to the town hall. Mr. Mayor, can you tell me where you were during the storm and what you experienced?
Well, I was in our barangay Tingib, 5 kilometers away from the town proper. And our house was used as evacuation center because almost all of the residents along the coastline were swept away by the flood. It's almost all of the places here were destroyed.
What are you doing in relation to recovering bodies? Because certainly in Tacloban, that's happening very slowly. Yeah. Are you able to speed up that process on this side?
We requested the provincial government, the Philippine Army, to assist us in retrieving the bodies and clearing the areas. But the retrieval of those bodies and the assistance of the government was concentrated or is concentrated in Tacloban City. So our clearing and the retrieval of bodies are also slow.
Residents here have told us that a series of huge waves hit this section of coast, and the damage is very much like what you would see in a tsunami zone. The combined population of these 30 villages is around 60,000, and the death toll is expected to be in the thousands.
Southeast Asia correspondent Zoe Daniel. The president of Palau, Tommy Remangasu, says typhoon recovery in his country is likely to be overshadowed by the major international effort in the Philippines, but he says his country can't recover on its own. The island of Cayangal was totally devastated by the typhoon, and there was major damage in the capital. The president says the northern Pacific once free of typhoons, but global warming may be responsible for Palau being hit by two major typhoons in less than 12 months. He speaks next to Brian Abbott.
Priorities definitely are power, which are down and will take quite a while to reestablish them. As you know, the salt water came and penetrated the local power station there, so it's still yet to be determined whether we can try to revive power generator that had serviced the island, or we may have to buy a replacement. But power is the main concern. Of course, water is, there's no access to water. Without electricity, the water pumps do not work. And the water reservoir was contaminated with salt water. We're trying to establish communication. It was down. Every antennas on the islands were down. So we're just using VHF radio right now and some iridium radios. The crops also, there's no sustainable way for anybody to live on the islands now. The crops are all destroyed and salt water is all over the island. So you can't grow food at least for the next 7 to 8 months until the ground is more fertile and not salty.
Of course, it was not only Cayangal that was badly damaged, but also in Karoor and Babeldaud there was damage. What are the priorities for the cleanup there?
Again, this is the same thing as you say, even in the so-called our capital and the district center, the business center. Power is the number one concern. We have to restore that as soon as possible. Water pipes broke, so some areas, we're on a water hours distribution right now. So we have waters for part of the day, and at night we have to refill the tanks. And communication is just coming up right now, but rural areas are also still without communication. Some schools are still closed because they don't have electricity and water, so you can't have classes. So these are the types of priorities that were basic services that need to be there in order for business and schools and residences to be able to live.
Are you fearful that any requests that you make for help will be overshadowed given the greater catastrophe in the Philippines?
Yes, first of all, we really feel bad also by the situation in the calamity in the Philippines. especially with the loss of life. While we were hit very hard, it's a miracle that we did not incur any fatalities. And that's really, we sympathize and offer our prayers to our neighbors and from the Philippines. But in a way, we know that they will and should receive the priority help that the international community can give them. We only hope that Palau is not forgotten and that we do get some help, because on our own, we certainly cannot meet the demands of what needs to be done.
For more information on the typhoon recovery, you can visit our website, pcjmedia.com/FAP, or Radio Australia. The reported deaths of men in tribal fighting in Papua New Guinea's Southern Highlands province may have originated in allegations of sorcery being involved in the death of a former member of parliament. That's according to PNG journalist Jack Tam, himself a Highlander, who's spoken to people in the area. The deaths of the Kamba tribesmen occurred when a grenade was allegedly thrown into the house of Sugo Valley in the Kagwa Ivrari electorate. Many others have been injured. Dak Tem says that fighting seems to have started when the death of the former MP sparked accusations of sorcery. He speaks next to Bruce Hill.
It is all about the former member, David Basu, from Eravikagwa Electorate in the Southern Islands province. He died some time ago. His tribesmen, plus other tribesmen, which they come from the same region, accusing another tribesman who is a councillor, saying that there is sort of sorcery involving in the death of that former member. So they are kind of asking or demanding some kind of explanation or compensation from him. And they maybe in the instant of that, they could have killed him, the councillor, which they were accusing of. From that, the other tribe is sort of trying to negotiate peace, where the tribe doesn't like fight anymore.
There are different accounts of what the casualties are. It's pretty clear that something very bad has happened. So this all really relates to the death of a member of parliament and allegations that sorcery might have been involved?
Actually, in the Highlands, it is different from other parts of Papua New Guinea. Naturally, people are now, at this time, we are believing or we are having some kind of belief that, you know, death is it is a natural thing. But then in our custom, when we're going back to some time ago, we see it as when somebody dies, like if a old person dies, then we know that that person is going to die because it comes to a stage that we're expecting him or her to die. But if someone is younger than that, we are not expecting him to die. But when he dies or she dies, why is that? How is that? So we have some kind of questions to find out the death. So in relation to that, you know, this is something that it happens. And these people are talking about their former member who died, could not have died, but why he died, because they were seeing some kind of links between the councillor, as there's allegation from the area there.
Obviously, high-powered modern weaponry is exacerbating the situation, making it much worse. But at its heart, isn't this a cultural thing? I mean, having the weapons or not having the weapons, the will to use them is clearly still there in the Highlands. Is it a cultural problem? And how do you go about changing culture?
I don't think this is a good idea when, you know, Highlanders, when we think about, you know, having at least one or two air rifles or guns in our society, or even in a tribesmen to, you know, protect ourselves.
People need guns for flying foxes and things like that.
That would be, when you're looking at that, you can look at, you know, some shotguns, something that is, you know, less power, cannot even do some, you know, major destruction. But this is something different. You're looking at using of grenade. It is not a must that the Highland tribesmen should have a gun, but then people still believe that they must have something in order to, you know, protect themselves. But I don't think this is a condition that they should have.
It's a warrior culture, isn't it?
Well, before it used to be warrior culture, because, you know, we have to, the forefathers have to protect themselves in order to survive, you know, gain kind of a lot of land, you know, make name. There's a lot of reasons. But today, as we're going towards the modern society and then the influence from the Christianity, we know that we are not more or less like a warrior tribe anymore. We are not living like that. We are trying to, you know, live as brothers and sisters. We want to promote peace and, you know, the human rights. That's what we always believe in. But, you know, in some instance, you know, things pop up in a way that we go back to our, you know, the typical mindset of our forefathers.
The diagnosis of tuberculosis was fundamentally changed around the world thanks to four Australians who were recently acknowledged as heroes in Australian science and technology. They were presented a prestigious scientific award. We have this special report from Desley Blanche.
In 1985, Dr. Paul Wood led that CSIRO team in searching for a rapid, that's within 24 hours, test for tuberculosis in cattle, as TB was a major issue in Australian cattle at the time.
Australia was running a national campaign to eradicate tuberculosis and brucellosis from its herds. And while it was going pretty well in the south, we still had some real significant problems in the north of Australia with our more remote pastoral areas.
Paul's team included fellow awardees, Drs. Jim Rothel and Tony Radford, and which was formed to develop a revolutionary test to be more accurate than the 100-years-old skin test, which was quite unreliable.
The skin test is a test that's done in the field, in cattle. It's subjective in nature because people have to feel and feel for a lump and decide whether the lump is significant enough. So it's very subjective. Cattle had to be held for 3 days, and in the remote areas, they're very stressed. So we needed a rapid test, in this case, less than 24 hours. We wanted it lab-based, so it was more subjective in its readout.
The problem with the skin test was that it was highly nonspecific. It tended to cross-react and cause false positives in any number of cattle, and that was costing a lot in terms of dead cattle and wasted time. And so what we needed to develop was something that was a lot more specific and really did identify truly infected animals.
Tony Radford came on board the team as a molecular biologist.
I came on to do all the cloning, clone genes, look for proteins, find things that would actually assist in getting a better test. And I worked with Paul, who was the immunologist, who actually did the fundamental work in defining the system we were going to use.
I was really fortunate early on to go up to the Northern Territory and see the situation where TB was diagnosed in cattle up there. So that helped me focus on some of the parameters we had to work on. So I knew it had to be pretty robust, couldn't have a lot of manipulation steps in it. So that helped us form the sort of ideas. Because it had to be lab-based, we always knew it was going to be with a blood sample taken from the animals and then processed in the lab.
We had to strictly look at the immune reaction that we could find in the animal. It may sound simple, but in fact, we had to come down to finding what was known as the T-cell reaction because nothing else was going to be there. And then we had to find a way of making that simple and easy and making it fast. And that was what we did.
A patent was lodged for a simple lab-based method to measure an immune response to TB infection. The crux of the invention is its reduction of a complex principle to a simple practice, and the critical trial for the new test involved a dairy herd in Victoria thought to contain TB-infected animals and included an animal named Dream Illusion.
I got a call from a veterinarian. He said he thought he had an infected herd, and when I tested all of the animals, there was only one animal positive. So he rang me and he said, look, sorry, there wasn't much there. And I said, yeah, just one animal, number 53. And when I post-mortemed that animal, it had TB. Because it was a dairy herd, it had a name, and the name was Dream Illusion.
But he'd used the old former test, hadn't he? And he'd taken how many days to get a result? And you had your test in?
Well, at that stage, it was still a prototype, but what we were looking for was a 24-hour turnaround, whereas the old test was a 3-day. And as I said, it was a rather subjective test.
And he called you all those days later, said, only one animal.
Yeah, he was apologetic. And for me, it was that complete elation you have as a scientist when you realise that what you thought was a good idea is actually a practical solution. So we don't have too many moments like that, and that was one great moment for me.
And dear old Dream Illusion became a mascot for the project.
Dream Illusion's tag sat on our fridge in our lab for many, many years.
This is when you and your team knew that you'd invented a new diagnostic test for TB, as you've said. But it would still be another 5 years before this became a commercial reality. And this was when Commonwealth Serum Laboratories, they're a large Australian drug development company, they came on board, and how Stephen Jones became involved in the project. To do what?
Well, this is where you need a bit of luck in science. So we had a prototype lab-based test, but we needed a commercial product. And fortunately for us, CSL had started a diagnostic program. Stephen Jones was recruited into that program. And we were able to convince CSL to have a look at this and develop a kit, a commercial kit for bovine TB. So that's work that Stephen did. But of course, then we actually had to take it out in the field and prove it really works. So, over the years, we tested many, many thousands of animals. And in the end, we tested them all around the world.
Well, first the TB test was for cattle, and other tests followed for what other animals?
Well, TB is a problem in many species, so obviously in humans, but in the veterinary community, TB in cattle is a problem in New Zealand, and they had possums as a reservoir in the UK, where they had badgers as a reservoir for TB. In South Africa, where they had lions and elephants. So we were able to adapt the same sort of technology and walk across the species. So we developed a primate assay, we developed one for deer, and of course, eventually one for humans as well.
Well, that's it. That was next. You teamed with Stephen Jones at CSL to adapt the technology into a new test for human TB diagnosis. And while it was exciting technology, in late 2000, CSL withdrew its interest in the field. So this is when Tony Radford re-enters the story, but we'll talk to him in a moment. But what did you do from then on for you?
We'd proven that the test worked in cattle, and CSL approached me one day and said, well, do you think this would work with humans? And I was able to pull out a whole lot of data that I'd used with a project with the Children's Hospital to show that it would. So then they set about a commercial product. But CSL's focus changed to become more of a blood product company, and we risked the loss of this technology overseas. And that's, you know, when we got together as a group and said, look, let's do this. And eventually Tony Radford and Jim Rothel were the ones that went ahead with finance, local finance, to create Celestis and to license the technology from CSL.
I was concerned that technology could be lost full stop, not just to Australia but to the world. And I felt that it was important that we got it out there. And Jim, Paul and I and Stephen all knew a way in which we could improve upon it and make it a really good human diagnostic. And we saw a lot of potential in that. So we said, let's start a company and do it ourselves.
So what's the main advantage of what you developed? This is a QuantiFERON TB Gold, it's called. What was the advantage over the skin test that was used for decades on humans way back to the 1890s, in fact?
The real advantage in our test is specificity, which means, in fact, that if you're a positive in our test, you truly are infected. It has a very low rate of false positive reactions. So that means that, you know, 99% of people who are positive truly have infection. When you compare that to the skin test in a Western society, often the skin test, 3 in 4 of people who are positive are in fact not infected at all. And they may go on to get treatment that they didn't need for 9 months, which is just a complete waste of time, money and effort. It also undermines the efficacy of the programs and costs money. And so that's what we did. We made a specific test, and it was fast.
Then you had to get it approved. You formed the company, made the test. What year is this?
We formed the company in 2000, and we got it approved at the very end of 2001 with the FDA.
Yeah, with the FDA. That's the United States Food and Drug Administration. So despite this, commercial resistance remained. Nobody was buying it. Why?
Well, not nobody, Desley.
Some people were buying it, but not enough. You're the commercial man.
All right. Well, what happened is we improved the test to make the QuantiFERON Gold test by 2004, it was. And at that time, we had the really specific test. And at that time, we had to really convince people to change their minds about what they thought about TB testing. But of course, they've been using the skin test for 100 years. And when you come along and have a test and you suddenly say, hang on, 3 out of 4 of those results you were calling positive and treating were wrong, it certainly shakes people up a bit. They are a bit staggered by the fact that they've been treating so many people for so long for so little purpose. So we had to convince them of that. And of course, we also had to change the practice. Our test is a laboratory-based test. The skin test is done in the clinic. So it was a change of practice and a change of funding and a change of mindset.
Was this among vets? Was it among regulatory bodies or government bodies? Was this where it was? Or guidelines had to be developed? Or?
Well, most of my work was done in the human test. And that's where guidelines had to be developed. We had to do lots of clinical research. We had to give the data, convince the people that wrote the guidelines, people around the world, from the Japanese Ministry of Health to the United States Centers for Disease Control, everybody, that in fact this was working, that it was giving the right answer, and that it was cost effective.
So, Tony, you were an inventor, a developer, and clinical researcher, and you brought a startup through to a successful international medical production and sales company and delivered a product that changed medical practices and which enhances global tuberculosis control. So why then was the company in 2011 taken over? What was your thinking at that point? Because you've run this successful company for 12 years?
12 years it would have been, yes. Well, apart from being all those things, Desley, I'm also a director of the company. And as a director, my responsibility was to accept a very fair price when it was offered. And it was a very fair price offered for the company. And it was also, to my mind, a good company to deal with. I felt the product was going to someone that would expand its sales, and they have done that. They have gone out and taken it to the world. They want to do more in TB, and they'll do more work in TB and expand upon what we've done. So I felt very comfortable with the people we were dealing with and with Qiagen and what they've done subsequently.
A tuberculosis diagnosis in animals and humans is technology that spanned more than 25 years in the lives of Jim Rothel, Stephen Jones, Paul Wood and Tony Radford. It all began with the Australian cattle industry.
It's great to look back over 27 years, and it started with funding from the cattle industry. The Australian cattle industry put the money into CSIRO because they were concerned about finishing off the TB eradication program. So they supported our work, and it's a credit to industries like that that really do put their own money back into research in this country.
And what's their advice to those following?
I think you want to tackle big issues. You want to look for where are the unmet needs in veterinary health and medical health. You want to be a bit brave. Don't get discouraged. It can be a long haul. Because it's a long haul, you've got to enjoy it. So you really need to enjoy the process as well as the outcomes. And I think science as a career is a fantastic thing, and I'd encourage people to get into it.
Well, my advice, particularly to people who came down the scientific pathway, is that you've got to get out and take a risk. You've got to see your opportunity and take it. And if you don't, you'll always be wondering. And what you've also got to do is realise that it's not always about the science. It's often about the personality. It's often about how you do things. Being effective as a scientist is getting something to happen. And you don't always get something to happen by ramming the data down someone's throat. Sometimes you have to be subtle, careful, and plan that. Try hard, and always remember there's EQ as well as IQ, and you'll get somewhere.
So what's your key to working together so successfully over such a long period of time?
Well, there's two things I often say. One, rather glibly, it's trust. Trust is the big thing. We've trusted each other implicitly over 25 years.
And with that report from Desley Blanche, we conclude this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address, of course, is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. And you can visit our website for more information and news on the region, pcjmedia.com/FAP. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pelham, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.